From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Iran accused Saudi Arabia of conducting airstrikes against its embassy in the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Some guards were reportedly wounded in the attack, according to state news channel IRIB. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Hussein Jabiri Ansari said Thursday that the Saudis were responsible for the damage to the embassy building and the injury to some of the staff. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Iran has condemned Saudi Arabia's air raid on its embassy building in Yemen. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hossein Jabri Ansari said Saudi jets deliberately struck Iran's mission in Sana'a. He said the action is in violation of all international laws and conventions regarding the immunity of diplomatic missions. Jabri Ansari said Riyadh is responsible for the injury of a number of security guards and material damage. The Foreign Ministry spokesman added that Tehran reserves the right to probe the airstrike, which occurred on Wednesday night. Saudi Arabia says it is investigating the attack.
Those airstrikes follow the attacks on Saudi embassies in Iran and elsewhere by protesters angered by last Friday's beheading by Riyadh of 47 people, including a prominent cleric and peace activist. Acknowledging that heavy airstrikes took place in Sana'a on Wednesday, a Saudi-led coalition spokesperson said the operation targeted missile launchers. RT's Paula Slyer filed this report.
The Saudi-led coalition that is fighting in Yemen says it will investigate the accusation. We're hearing from a coalition spokesperson who says that on Wednesday night, jets did carry out heavy airstrikes in Sana'a. He says that they were targeting missile launchers that are used by Houthi militia. Now, the Saudis accused the Houthis of using civilian facilities, including hiding among abandoned embassies. All of this comes as Iran bans the import of all products that are made in Saudi Arabia. The decision was made in a cabinet meeting on Thursday, and it follows the announcement by Saudi Arabia that it is cutting ties with Iran after the storming over the weekend by Iranian protesters on Saudi diplomatic missions in Iran. Now, that followed the execution by Riyadh of a top-ranking Shia cleric. So certainly tensions are increasing here in the region.
An H-bomb for North Korea.
The underground nuclear test announced by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea on 6th January is deeply troubling.
That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking to journalists Wednesday about the underground nuclear test that was announced by North Korea.
This act is profoundly destabilizing for regional security and seriously undermines international non-proliferation efforts. I condemn it unequivocally. I demand the DPRK cease any further nuclear activities and meets its obligations for verifiable denuclearization. We are monitoring and assessing developments in close coordination with the concerned international organizations, including the CTBTO, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, and interested parties.
According to the head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, such a hydrogen bomb test, if confirmed, would be a clear violation of UN Security Council resolutions. The council rushed to take up the matter late in the day Wednesday. Matthew Wells reports.
Work is beginning immediately on a new UN Security Council resolution in the wake of North Korean claims that it's carried out a hydrogen bomb test. The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, known as DPRK, claimed to have carried out the underground nuclear test on Tuesday. So far, this has not been verified by the UN. Security Council members said in a statement that the gravity of DPRK's apparent violation of previous resolutions aimed at curbing its nuclear program demanded an immediate response. Motohide Yoshikawa is Japan's UN ambassador, which has a seat on the council.
If no further significant measures are taken by the Security Council, the authority and the credibility of the Security Council will be put into question. Our aim is to have swiftly a new resolution which has a robust contents.
The DPRK announced that it had carried out what it said was a successful hydrogen bomb test on Monday night. If confirmed, it would be the country's fourth nuclear test since 2006. Initial reports from the Preparatory Commission for the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, or CTBTO, said that an unusual seismic event had been recorded at the site where the DPRK has previously carried out confirmed tests. If this one is confirmed, it would constitute a grave threat to international peace and security, said the CTBTO's Executive Secretary, Lassina Zerbo. He urged the DPRK to refrain from any further testing and said he hoped the so far unconfirmed testing of a powerful hydrogen bomb would serve as the final wake-up call to the international community to bring the test ban treaty into force. The IAEA Director General Yukiya Amano said if confirmed, the test was a clear violation of international law and deeply regrettable. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
Meanwhile, South Korea said it will restart propaganda loudspeaker broadcasts along the border with the North following Pyongyang's claimed hydrogen bomb test. The broadcast will restart on Friday, according to the presidential office in Seoul, calling the North's bomb test a grave violation of an agreement in August between the two Koreas. At that time, the two traded artillery fire after Pyongyang had demanded a halt to the broadcasts. The agreement was aimed to ease tensions at that time. Seoul has already restricted access to Kaesong Industrial Park, the last significant joint project with Pyongyang. That site provides jobs for 53,000 North Koreans. At the UN in New York Wednesday, Dr. Lassina Zerbo, Executive Secretary of the Preparatory Commission for the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, briefed the press by video link. He described the difficulties his group faces in determining whether or not there was a hydrogen bomb explosion in the DPRK.
We need a couple of days to be able to come back with what we call the smoking gun that we could correlate for our member states to draw the conclusion on the nature of the event. And this is what we're busy working on. First, to determine with certainty that we're not dealing with a natural event, that we're dealing with a man-made event, which is likely an explosion. And then, second, to find the correlation through our atmospheric transport modeling into that Korean Peninsula to link the two for our state signatory for a qualitative decision. This is what I can share with you at this point in time.
Roger Wareham is a human rights attorney and longtime activist based in New York, who's visited North Korea. He spoke with CPR's Bernard White via telephone Thursday.
When did you go to North Korea?
Well, actually, I was there, I was 20 years ago. Even though the 20 years later, the difference between how North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, was portrayed and what was actually going on, was the same, and it's a similar tactic that this country always uses. I know back in 2008, I was in Zimbabwe when the elections were going on, and the Western media portrayed there was chaos, the army was in the streets, and people were in hiding, and I was walking in the streets of Harare, and the army wasn't in the streets. But I mean, people were calling me, telling me, you got to be careful because so we have to, and I know it's really preaching to the choir with your audience, but we have to be very critical in terms of how we read and what we accept mainstream media. We can't separate it from what's the agenda of the United States government, whose interest is mainstream media protecting.
However, there are still many in North Korea who remember the early 1950s, when the U.S. Air Force destroyed every city, town, and village in the country.
It traveled in moonlight, so my impression was that I am traveling on the moon, because there was only devastation, and in a very funny way, every city was a collection of chimneys. I don't know why houses collapsed and chimneys did not, but I saw thousands of chimneys, and that was all.
600,000 tons of bombs exploded on the north. More than 2 million civilians were killed.
When I filmed the destruction of the city by the B-29 aircraft, I had to tie myself and my camera onto a large pillar, since otherwise I would have been blown away. If a large bomb, such as a one-ton bomb, exploded, the blast was so strong it would demolish everything within 150 feet, just like paper. As I was filming, the child begged me to save his mother's life. He didn't realize she was already dead. I went on filming him through my tears. I had my job to do as a cameraman. I didn't stop even to wipe away his blood or strap up the wound on his back. I still feel a dreadful pain today whenever I remember that scene.
Brian Becker is with the Answer Coalition. He's also the host of a new program on Radio Sputnik, Loud and Clear. He's been to the DPRK numerous times over the past two decades, and we spoke with him via Skype from Washington, D.C. Thursday. So, Brian, you've been to DPRK a number of times, and maybe you could tell us a little bit from your perspective what you see happening here.
Well, this is the fourth nuclear test that the DPRK North Korea has announced. And the difference between this and the other tests is that they are asserting that this was the test of a miniature hydrogen bomb, which would be a huge technological advance if it turns out to be the case. They say it's the case. They say it's been verified, that it's verified scientifically, that it was done safely. From a technological point of view, it's a major development for the DPRK because it would show that the country is making large technological strides in the issue, in the question of military development, and particularly its nuclear arsenal. Politically, it's created, as would have been anticipated, and I'm sure the DPRK did anticipate, a firestorm of opposition. You have right-wing forces in South Korea today burning in effigy Kim Jong-un, the young leader of the DPRK. The South Korean government has announced that it's going to resume, as of tomorrow, South Korea time, Korea time, the propaganda broadcasts across the DMZ. The South Korean broadcasts against DPRK into DPRK territory was the issue that triggered a near war in August of this of 2015, if you remember, that was averted by a negotiated solution at the end of August.
Right.
The fact that South Korea is going to do that again means, I think, undoubtedly that DPRK will climb the escalation ladder as South Korea climbs it. So I think we can anticipate that there's going to be a lot of tension in the Korean Peninsula, the most militarized part of the planet, and the possibilities are that there could be even, you know, military clashes there.
I mean, you still have U.S. occupation of Okinawa and Japan and South Korea, and you know, if you look at the whole region, really, there's a huge U.S. military presence there.
It's vast. I mean, it's 37,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. They haven't left since they arrived in 1950. That was 65 years ago.
They must be pretty old now, those guys.
That's right. And you have Okinawa, big parts of Japan occupied. The United States, when it enters countries, doesn't really or very rarely has ever left. So they continue to keep the troops there under some pretext. But the real reason they're there is they're an extension of American power, obviously.
Right.
And from the point of view of the DPRK, those troops and the military exercises that those troops and the U.S. Navy and the U.S. force engage in twice a year on the shores of North Korea constitute a real menace because, as we all know, the United States bombed North Korea for real, not as a war game, but for real between 1950 and 1953. And by 1951, the principal complaint of the pilots was that there was nothing left to bomb because there was, in fact, not one structure higher than one story still standing as a consequence of U.S. bombing. Yeah. So when the U.S. carries out the simulated bombing now of the DPRK, including sending, as it did a year ago, its most advanced nuclear aircraft all the way from Nebraska, nonstop flights to simulate the nuclear bombing of North Korea and flying directly back, showing the North Koreans that they have this capability. Of course, the DPRK says, well, that's all the more reason that our country, unlike Iraq, which was monitored by weapons inspectors, unlike Libya, which decided to give up weapons of mass destruction after the Iraq invasion, unlike those countries that were then targeted and destroyed, we are going to become stronger militarily. And that's the real context for the nuclear test and the nuclear advancement carried out by the DPRK.
We had just heard a clip before of one of the survivors of the bombings back in the early 50s by the United States, that in his village, the only thing in his village, the only things that remained were the chimneys. The houses and all of the structures were blown over by these huge bombs.
Everything was gone. Everything. Can you imagine? I mean, Korea as a country, both North and South, was relatively small in population-wise, about 28, 29 million. By the end of 1953, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica of 1967, 5 million Koreans had died from that war, either because of bombs or guns or famine or, you know, disease related to dislocation of refugees. 5 million out of 27, 28 million. I mean, by any standards, that, you know, that rises to genocide.
Yeah.
And those people died not because they had necessarily done something wrong, but because they were Koreans and they were targeted. And the American military was like, we don't care. We're going to just carpet bomb you and carpet bomb you and carpet bomb you until you say uncle. And the people in North Korea never did say uncle. And thus, the U.S. had its first military setback. They had gone all the way to the northern part of North Korea, to the Yalu River that borders China. And then the combination forces of North Korean regular and guerrilla forces and Chinese volunteers, more than a million of them pouring across the border, pushed the American forces back below the south of the 38th parallel, where Korea had been divided at the end of World War II. And the U.S., I think, has just never forgiven North Korea for not having been defeated. I mean, in essence, and that explains one of the reasons that explains the nonstop animus by the United States against the DPRK.
And then, of course, if you look at the crawling map of Europe from 1945 until the Ukrainian crisis, but certainly from 1991 until then. In Asia, moving up the Korean Peninsula to the borders of Russia and China would be a similar move, and the U.S. has shown an appetite for that.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, the Cold War had an ideological component, and that ideological component was the defeat of communism and socialism, because the victory of communism or socialism in the minds of the Pentagon, the CIA, and Wall Street bankers meant the extinguishing of the capitalist social order that they dominate and, you know, make huge fortunes from. So socialism and communism represented a movement that would create an alternative way society and society's economy was organized. But there's another element to the Cold War, because the Cold War continued, as we see with Russia, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is not simply ideological. It's part of a war against any force that constitutes an obstacle to the unmitigated, unobstructed expansion of capitalism and corporate domination, particularly American Wall Street-dominated corporations. And wherever there's an obstacle to them being able to buy the property, buy the land, own the factories, own the transport, own the public services, wherever an entity constitutes some sort of obstacle or restraint on them, that obstacle is also targeted for destruction. So there's There's the other part of the Cold War, which is the sort of organic expansionism of modern-day capitalism and imperialism.
And, of course, there's the entire shifting geopolitical context between the U.S., Russia, China, the BRICS, and others. And Korea, again, is at the center of a lot of that. China has been making moves and commercial agreements with South Korea and Japan separately. There's been some movement in the economic sphere, at least, towards getting past, in any event, the historical animosities between China, Japan, Korea.
Very true. I mean, it's a very complicated situation because Japan was the imperialist country and China and Korea were the oppressed and colonized or semi-colonized countries. And Japanese imperialism imposed such human suffering and misery through those occupations and invasions. But you are right that the emergence of China as the second largest economy, perhaps soon to be the biggest economy in sort of large-scale aggregate terms, the fact that Japan and China could be mutual and are mutual trading partners, very, very large, but perhaps the biggest trading partners with each other. And in the case of South Korea, the South Korean people, like the North Korean people, have animus towards Japan because of colonialism and because of racism, racism which is still practiced against Korean populations inside of Japan even today. But the South Korean economy is also more and more integrated with both Japan and China. So yes, you're right. The idea that the U.S. would be able to maintain a unipolar domination, you know, that idea that was so popular in 1991 after the shocking collapse of the Soviet Union. Here we are 24 and a half years later. That turns out to be more or less a fantasy. That was a very, very short-lived period of history, like a blink of an eye, because China is growing. There are lots of centrifugal forces at work. The U.S. empire is not like marching into its heyday. In fact, it's got limitations, and the networks of a power and authority that it's maintained, you know, in some ways have come undone. But that's why we should also remember that U.S. is not going to take the slipping of the American empire lightly. And Obama, not a Republican, not George W. Bush, but President Obama, announced in Australia a couple of years ago the Asia Pivot. And the Asia Pivot meant the placement by 2020 of the lion's share of all U.S. aircraft, attack aircraft, and the U.S. naval fleet in the Pacific region. That's in order to contain China, to stop China, to break up the possible integration in Asia that would sort of challenge American hegemony there.
And in the midst of this like kaleidoscopic set of relations almost between China, Japan, Korea, the United States, you have the U.S. and the Abe government, you know, unchaining essentially the Japanese military, at least in terms of the constitutional restrictions that were on it. Is the U.S. sort of designating Japan as an agent, or is there some other move underway there?
Yes and no, because the United States is also aware that they're strengthening their security ties with Japan. That's partly to have Japan play a more aggressive role, but it's also to bind Japan closer to the United States. Because, and I think, well, let me finish the thought. I think that the United States also fears Japan becoming additionally independent of the United States. And so, for instance, you take the North Korean nuclear test. There are forces within the Abe government, the Japanese government, that are very right-wing, very nationalistic, and very militaristic, who feel that the apologies after World War II were a mistake, that Japan needs to regain its lost glory. They want to and are getting rid of the article in the Constitution that forbids Japan from having a standing army that can be deployed in foreign places. They take the North Korean nuclear test as one more, I would say, dominant piece of evidence about why Japan must go nuclear. And if that were to happen, and if Japan and the Japanese military has possession of its own nuclear arsenal, the United States fears that that could completely destabilize Asia from the point of view of the exercise of U.S. domination too. And yet there will be, I believe, a compelling argument made within the Japanese ruling circles that Japan should go nuclear, even though the Japanese population, I mean, is the most anti-nuclear population in the world. Of course, the Japanese people have suffered nuclear attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I think this is another factor where the U.S. realizes that North Korea taking these actions has the effect of accelerating the tendency within Japan for the acquisition of a nuclear arsenal that it can boldly and openly talk about. And I think that, too, by the way, is a primary fear that China has, the People's Republic of China, which is a historic ally of the DPRK. But as you can see by their pronouncements, both at the UN and elsewhere, they're very much against the DPRK's nuclear test, partly because they know that, you know, once these tests happen, once there's an escalation on any quarter, all the other players in the region will, you know, follow suit. From the DPRK's point of view, they consider China to be a historic ally, but they don't want to be told by China what to do. And they don't feel that China is always a reliable ally because China's national interests or the perception of them can be placed ahead of and have been placed ahead of the interests of the DPRK. So I think that's another factor from the in terms of the DPRK's own calculations.
You had yesterday Lucina Zerbo from the CTBTO. More or less suggesting to the international community that he kind of skirted it. It was very diplomatic language, but cutting through all of that, suggesting that people need to sit down with North Korea and kind of create an environment where this is not in their interest to follow this whole line. What do you think are the chances of that politically?
I think it's possible. I don't think it's likely, but I think it is possible. The DPRK, by the way, and this is extremely important for your listeners to be aware of, in January 2015, exactly 1 year ago, offered to suspend all future nuclear weapons tests if the United States and South Korea would cancel war games against the DPRK. And the United States... What the United States said in response was, no, we are not going to cancel our war games. They're going forward. And of course, as I said, these war games simulate the invasion and destruction of North Korea. But they said, if North Korea promises not to have any future nuclear tests, all things are possible, meaning a suggestion of possible normalization of relations, a peace treaty technically and legally ending the Korean War. And the North Koreans' consideration was that's just not enough. The United States didn't do what it needed to do, which was to cancel the war games. And by canceling the war games, that good faith effort would have been, I think, easily and quickly embraced by the Kim Jong-un DPRK leadership. And there could have been, as we saw with Iran, the beginning of a negotiations process as opposed to the beginning of a bigger, wider war. So I do think there is the possibility, but it's not a question, and this is what is where people are most confused. It's not because the DPRK is so belligerent. It's because the United States so far has refused to make any major significant gesture towards the DPRK that the DPRK could embrace as a good faith gesture. And I think if the U.S. did do it, wanted to do it, as Clinton started to do in the last year of his administration in 2000, when he sent Madeleine Albright to the DPRK and it looked like the normalization of relations might be possible. If the U.S. did do it, I think the DPRK would be completely open and embracing of that path.
Brian Becker, thank you very much and look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.